Good morning. The deal to study how the Navy should fix its leaky fuel tanks isn't making some local lawmakers happy. Senator Laura Thielen joins us later this hour to talk about the Red Hill rehab. And development often draws opponents. We'll talk with one of the two young men spearheading the protest over the expansion of Princeville. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. Also on the Garden Isle, if it's a Saturday night in Kilauea, and it's artistic, there's a reasonable chance that our guest, Courtney Puig, has an aesthetic hand in it. Volunteering in vacations? Well, most of us don't volunteer to go on vacation, but are volunteering to help the environment while you're on vacation? That's the Kuleana of Pacific Whale Foundation's Laura Blickley.
That's the conversation for this Monday, July 20th. Coming up next, the news. Welcome to a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and joining me for the next couple of weeks while Chris Vandercook is away on vacation, Bill Sage is sitting in. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I'm just wondering if, after what we heard on NPR's news, if I can have the strength of Ant-Man and figure out finally if we are truly alone in the universe or there's someone else. Well, immediately I can say I have the strength to say that we are not alone in the studio.
No, we're not. And we're not going to be alone in the studio because we've got you and we're here with you and guests too. And we're going to start with this first conversation. Now, a look to rehab the Navy's Red Hill fuel storage facility. The January 2014 leak of 27,000 gallons galvanized local officials and the EPA. 7 weeks ago, they announced what was termed a landmark agreement with the Navy to fix those storage tanks. But first, there would be a feasibility study, then perhaps a 20-year plan to upgrade the tanks. The agreement also includes a dispute resolution process, with the EPA getting the final say. Last week, some lawmakers issued their own letter of concern about the deal, which Senator Laura Thielen calls a huge error in judgment. Senator Thielen joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
When we talked with Jared Blumenfeld, the Region 9 head of the EPA, right after this deal came out, he said that he was not concerned about the long projected time because it was really hinging on the feasibility study, that it was going to be a case of almost, you know, they either did it or they didn't do it, no matter what the cost was. And he felt that the Navy would, in fact, do what they had to do to rehab Red Hill, because of the fact that we have Pearl Harbor. Is that the only alternative?
Well, I guess what I'd say is, first of all, it's not no matter what the cost is, because under the agreement, the type of technology that's going to be chosen to upgrade the tanks, it does depend on the cost. And so the agreement specifically states that they would use the best available practicable technology, and practicable would include whether it's too expensive. And if it is too expensive, they would have the ability to reject that and to pick a less best technology, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the point, that they either did it or they were going to have to go do something else. But in his mind, it seemed to be that something else would simply be to not have the station here in Hawaii, and that that seemed not to be practicable because we have Pearl Harbor. So the idea of having all tanks in one place, is that the only option that you see?
No. The Navy and the Pacific Command have a variety of options for storing their fuel. But storing fuel is a difficult and expensive prospect. So they are working very hard to keep the Red Hill fuel tanks because it's their largest strategic reserve of fuel in the Pacific. Now, in order to upgrade the tanks, and we'll talk about, you know, what that means in a minute, they're going to have to spend a fair amount of money. So the Navy has the choice. They could either put that money into upgrading these tanks, or they could also start to diversify their fuel storage and build new tanks in some of the other areas in the Pacific where they have it. So I think they have a variety of options in front of them.
These tanks are over 70 years old. We know that they've been leaking many times over that time period. But to have to go and bring them to current technology, which would require a double-walled tank, may or may not be what they choose to do with these tanks because they have to rehab them. Is that a safe alternative just to say that they're going to rehab them?
No, in my mind, it is not a safe alternative. So these tanks are between 72 to 75 years old. To be clear, you would never, ever, ever get permission to build these tanks the way they are today. You would have to build a double-lined tank, especially one that's over an aquifer. I don't think you would, probably even with a double-lined tank, get permission to build them today. These tanks started leaking pretty soon after they were built. They've had a history of leaks dating back to the 1940s, and apparently pretty regularly, although the Navy didn't report these to the state until in the late 80s or 90s, I think it was. The Navy is not committing in the agreement to using the best available technology to double line the tanks. So that's, to me, one of the biggest concerns. If we're going to enter into an agreement to allow the Navy to keep these tanks over one of our primary aquifers for the island of Oahu, then I think they should be required to use the best available technology or an equal alternative. If they come up with an alternative to double lining that is equal in safety, then I think, you know, that would be acceptable.
You mentioned the several different times that they have been leaking over the past 70 or so years and not really acknowledging that until the 80s. What about the water testing going on during that time?
I'm not sure what the water testing was going on in the early years. And from reading the record and in talking to the parties, apparently the state was not even aware of the existence of these tanks until there was a civil engineering award that came in, I think, in the 90s. And so then the state started asking questions about the tanks, and I think the Board of Water Supply as well. But there was some question about, you know, whether this was a military secret, and I think information has been, there was a history of, I guess, a lot of effort being made to get some information, and I'm not sure still whether we have full information about the maintenance records and the leakage. I have seen some documents where some of the leaks prior to the 90s in about the amount of 130,000 gallons of jet and marine diesel fuel, but that wasn't all the leakage. That was only what they had records of that they were able to share with us, and there was quite a number of other leaks from other tanks that they just had no idea how much had gone out.
So last week when you and other lawmakers were meeting with the Department of Health and certainly discussing all of this is in light of the proposal from, or brought out by the EPA and the agreement, what happens with how we go forward when there's known leakage and they say the contaminants are making their way into the groundwater, certainly into the Navy's supply of it? They don't seem to be terribly concerned about it, but should we?
I think we should, and the point people should understand is right now, we have a draft, like a settlement agreement, basically, because there was a spill of 27,000 gallons of fuel in December of 2013. And so the Navy, the US EPA, the Department of Health, and the contractor that basically manages the fuel have drafted a proposed settlement agreement. The Navy and their contractor want to sign that agreement, but the state and the US EPA have gone out for public comment, and they have to consider the public comments, and they have the option at this point to decide, do they sign the agreement as is, or do they return to negotiations and try to negotiate a better agreement that takes into consideration the public comment. So the public comment period closes today. About 18 Oahu legislators have co-signed a letter where we ask that the State Department of Health go back into negotiations and negotiate a better agreement. The Board of Water Supply is submitting a comment today. I think it's a fairly extensive one. And I believe they've gotten about 100 or 150 comments, I think they said, when we met with the military last week. I would encourage people, if they can, to submit a comment. And if they can't, to send an email to the governor, to your legislators, and to weigh in, because this is the period of time, you know, over the next couple months, where the Department of Health is going to decide, do they go with this agreement or do they try to negotiate something better?
The point that you're making is that this is not a done deal, despite the way it in some ways has been characterized.
It is absolutely not a done deal. And the Department of Health and the US EPA should be taking into account the public comment at this period.
Meanwhile, what about the water testing? Because for people who are saying, you know, you can have all the feasibility studies you want, you can discuss this until the cows come home, but for people who are drinking the water, that's their bottom line, what they're putting in their bodies.
At this point, they have found the chemicals that are found in these fuels in the aquifer. And it has been, these chemicals have been tested at the well that the Navy uses to draw for its facility. The Board of Water Supply wells are farther away, and they pull from deeper in the aquifer. And the water testing there has not found the chemicals at the Board of Water Supply at this point. But what the Board of Water Supply is asking for is more modeling to be done to determine the flow of the groundwater. The Navy, when we met with them last week, several of the members told me, oh, the contaminants can't reach the Board of Water Supply wells. But I understand from talking to the Board of Water Supply that the Navy does have an old contract where they had modeled some of the water, and there is some ground flow in that direction. And then we also know from the work the University of Hawaii has been doing is that as the sea levels are rising, that our groundwater supply is going to start to be compressed, because our fresh water sits on top of the salt water. And as that salt water rises under the ocean, you know, the UH is already showing in places like Waikiki, other areas during high tides, you know, the ocean's coming up farther. We don't know how that's going to affect the flow of the groundwater from places like under the Red Hill. So we need, in order to know the long-term protection of our water supply, have more monitoring wells done, have more modeling done to determine the flow of that underground water. But to me, the biggest thing is, you know, you can model and test all you want, but once that water is contaminated, it's contaminated. So the key thing is, what do you do with those tanks to make sure they stop leaking? Because we can't afford to have more go into the aquifer, because once it's contaminated, these chemicals stick around for generations.
When we talked to the Department of Health last year, one of the things that they said is that similar to what you just said a moment ago, that, you know, the original thought was that this is not going to migrate into the Board of Water Supply wells. But the fact that we don't know, and that there are real unknowns, do you think that the Department of Health was being complacent?
You know, I think they made an error in judgment about the depth of concern and appreciation people have for the aquifer. A lot of time when you read through these agreements and when you talk to the Department of Health, a lot of concern is stated about the cost for the military of having to find alternative fuel supplies. But what I didn't see anywhere is, what's the cost to the residents of the island of Oahu if we don't have that aquifer? I think it's much bigger. And so we need to start to take that, you know, and give it equal consideration or greater consideration when we go back to the bargaining table.
The comment period, as you mentioned, closes today.
Yes.
But there is still some time for people to get their comments in. But after that point, for some people, that's not going to be a possibility to say anything. So after that point, what can someone do?
I think, again, the more people who express their concern, both in individual conversations as well as publicly, the more strength the Department of Health will feel and the governor would feel in going back to the bargaining table. It's difficult to bargain with the Navy. I mean, they're pretty big. And so I think they need to understand that they have a lot of backing from the residents of Oahu. I know it sounds silly, but letters to the editor, calls into radio shows, calls to your legislature, calls to the governor, those kinds of things, emails, they make a lot of difference, because when we see as policymakers that there is a depth of concern out there, then we pay more attention to the issue.
You're really saying make it an issue.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about it this morning.
Sure.
Thanks for the time. Senator Laura Thielen represents the 25th Senatorial District, Kailua to Portlock. She is a former chair of the Department of Land and Natural Resources.
This is The Conversation on member support at HBR2. It's 8:20, coming up from Kauai Art for Everyone's Sake, but first, your backyard quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhawaiti.
It's summertime, and a lot of people are spending time in the water to cool off. So go put on your snorkeling gear and join us as we take a swim with the Hawaiian Sergeant Major. It's one of the most common damselfish species in Hawaii, and these reef fish truly live up to their English name. Even as juveniles, Sergeant Major dominates other fish. They eat algae, plankton, and small organisms found on the surface, and as they grow and mature, they migrate into deep water about 15 to 30 feet down along the vertical reef faces. That's where the Sergeant Major thrives, growing up to 10 inches as an adult. They have yellow-green bodies with light bellies and five dark vertical bands on either side. Now, when courting females or guarding their nests, these fish will frantically swim in circles. But the more interesting spectacle is the male's ability to change the color of his stripes from black to yellow. For today's quiz, can you tell us the Hawaiian name of the Sergeant Major damselfish? You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first person with the right answer takes home an HBR t-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose Flex Plus MBA program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Most Oahu folks know about downtown Honolulu's First Friday celebration, and on Kauai and Kilauea Town, they do much the same thing for the last Saturday of each month and call it Kilauea Art Night. Working artist Courtney Puig has loved and lived on Kauai for a decade, and in 2013 she founded the monthly event full of arts, crafts, food, and entertainment centered at Kilauea's historic stone building. It's wildly popular with local residents and visitors alike, and it's a pleasure to have Courtney with us by phone this morning. Aloha, Courtney.
Aloha, good morning.
So I am assuming you came over from some other island or a much larger place and settled on Kauai?
I did. I moved here from New York City. I grew up in Louisiana in a small town, and when I visited, I just fell in love with Kauai, and it reminded me of home, and I wanted to be here.
So once you got here, you were working as a graphic artist. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to work with Judy Walker of Topps Malibu and design products for her here, and on Kauai.
And with the bag recycling issue going through the legislature pretty much statewide, you got into actually making a brand new bag out of, upcycling?
Yeah, you know, designing products for her each year, she taught me how to create my own product. And I recycle T-shirts from thrift stores, cut them, sew them, dye them, and screen print them. And I've sold over probably 8,000 bags in about 6 years.
And that was when you moved to Kauai, you moved directly up to Kilauea?
I moved right outside of Kilauea at Kalihiwai.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So you're up there and you have your own bag, as it were, and also into pottery.
Oh, yeah. I love creating vessels, functional art. And after making so many bags and it being the same form, I've always been drawn to pottery my entire life. And recently, over the past year and a half, I've become a professional potter. So enjoyable.
So your art essentially is the art of containment in one way or another.
It is.
Cloth, be it clay. Things that begin with kl. Now, as you come to Kilauea, you come to a cliff, so you have cloth and clay and cliffs, but you also have Kilauea Town and the stone building. What gave you the idea that Kilauea Town needed something more?
Well, you know, Kilauea is such a small community, and it's a wonderful working town, and there are not many opportunities for artists to share their work because a lot of the markets here are closed, and there's wait lists for 2-3 years to get into farmers markets here. So I wanted to create something for the community and have an open market with art and allow the community here to share their work and create a place to be seen and heard as an artist.
Well, that seems like an admirable thing to do. So you had, in the artist community, a working Kilauea, I've had the fortune of seeing that beautiful town. So along with some wonderful upscale restaurants, you almost don't surprise in that beautiful bird sanctuary. How many actual working artists would you say are in the area?
Oh, man, there's to sustain yourself here on Kauai, I think you do have to be entrepreneurial. And at the Art Walk, there's about 50 artisans that attend each month, from woodworkers, painters, jewelry artisans. It's, you know, there's a lot of working artists here.
So the historic stone building, this is sort of, I can hear the local, the stone building. It's was it a county courthouse sort of affair?
It used to be a dispensary, actually, because Kilauea was, a farming town, a sugarcane town.
Oh,
so
right.
It was a dispensary, and it's beautiful stone building that has a big roundabout and a back grassy lawn, and it's a family-friendly place to come and stroll.
Had you been to Oahu's, the Honolulu's First Friday? That sort of give you an inspiration of the same sort of thing, only sort of front to back?
You know, I went to, I attended Art and Flea, and that's put on by Allie, and she's from Kauai, and so I would go to attend Art and Flea each month, the third Thursday of the month, and I actually did Honolulu Night Market. And the way that was coordinated and organized, it inspired me and gave me the foundation to bring it back to Kauai to create something similar here.
And you just met with the artist one night and said, hey, let's do this, gang.
Exactly. No, I was actually going through a divorce, and my friends rallied around me and supported this idea that I had had for... Ever since I moved here, I had the idea at that building for maybe 6 years. And one of my closest girlfriends said, Courtney, do it. And doing it, it gave me a lot of self-confidence. And it really fulfilled me to be able to give back to the community. And brought me a lot of joy.
So as you brought back the joy, it's one of the things I've noticed you've... your daughter apparently is a big point of pride in your life. Do you find that you can inspire her through the work of other artists and people who come to see these beautiful?
Oh yes. Belle is a budding potter herself, and she likes to come and set up with me and bring her creations. And I bring my pottery wheel out and I do live demonstrations, and the children just gather around, and people are mesmerized by that art form. And so there's a lot of live demonstrations as well, like children fire dancers come and perform, but my daughter is definitely inspired.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful inspiration for everybody, Kamaaina and the visitors alike who are there. And this is going to be the last Saturday of the month, which I think will be the 25th this month, and there's the Kilauea Art Night. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Courtney, and I wish you all success every last Saturday of the month in Kilauea Town.
Thank you.
Yes, Courtney is definitely going to do something wonderful for the entire area, and she is now at Kilauea, and up on Kilauea, she is having the time of her life being very, very artistic. And she's a 10-year resident. And she's found selling her products from her professional pottery studio at Farmers Markets Islandwide. For more information, visit our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Constitution says you are presumed innocent. The judge says not so fast.
I could not control my future, and the basic American dream to me was a ransom of $2 million.
If you can't make bail, your rights are suddenly not free. The ugly little secret about the bail system in America, next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
HPR brings you in-depth reporting from sources around the globe and from our own award-winning news team, the largest radio newsroom in Hawaii. We thank well-informed listeners Val Johnson of Honolulu, Patrick Venierson of Mountain View, and Anna Diaz of Paia for choosing to support this station with their membership. Make HPR your current affair. Become a member today by calling us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can visit hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from The Joy of Sake, a sake celebration featuring more than 391 sakes to taste and sake-friendly appetizers from 21 restaurants, July 31st at the Hawaii Convention Center. joyofsake.com. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, striving to increase informed discussions about life in Hawaii, around the Pacific, and the world through support of HPR's local and national news programming. More on Facebook or Matson.com.
Years ago, a veteran teacher took a look at the proposed state's educator effectiveness system. She not only took issue with part of it, she refused to complete it, and that set her up for a subpar rating that could have affected her pay this year. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check of the teacher who stood up the DOE. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So tell me about this teacher. She takes a look at this 3 years ago, and she has a real problem with a part of it and just decides not to do that part?
That's basically it. Her name is Mireille Ellsworth. She's an English and drama teacher at Waiakea High School in Hilo. She's been a teacher for 18 years, long time, and she really objected to linking teacher pay, her pay, to the test scores of students. She says it's unfair. She actually called it a dog and pony show. And so she appealed this, and interestingly enough, she actually won the appeal, although the Department of Education says she won on a technicality. There was a procedural error, apparently, with the way her evals were processed. But she's hoping that her victory, because she's now received an effective rating rather than a subpar one, she's hoping it sends a message and emboldens other teachers to challenge this system, which has been controversial since it was first implemented about 3 years ago.
I mean, she's setting a precedent for a lot of other teachers who may have the same or a similar concern with the whole evaluation system.
Right. I remember the new teacher union leadership, they actually ran in part on a platform to get rid of this system. They do not like it. The system has been discussed since 2010. It's actually been scaled back three times. There's been a lot of meetings, stakeholder meetings between teachers and administrators and so forth. It is not very popular. You know, there's a lot of ways to evaluate whether a student is doing well or not and what might influence that. I mean, we've talked about these things on this program. Poverty. You know, how involved are the parents? How big is the class size? Are they getting enough food, right? But many studies say the absolute best indicator is whether or not you have an outstanding teacher. It's a huge determinant in terms of how the student will perform.
And about performance, let's talk a little bit about some of the evaluation system that asks them to sort of project how their students are going to perform or to set goals for them. I mean, wasn't part of her issue that, you know, that would somehow be undercutting a child's ability to do better than a teacher might expect or then to change how the teacher might teach to that child?
That's exactly right. It's called Student Learning Objectives. SLO is the acronym. And the teachers are asked to predict the growth or the achievement of each student. Well, Murray Ellsworth says, look, you know, that can be easily manipulated by teachers. What they're doing is essentially grading themselves. So how are they going to do an evaluation? Well, they're probably going to give themselves pretty good marks. And remember, this is also tied into the Race to the Top federal grants, right? So there's a financial incentive that's involved here. This is a national discussion about whether teacher evals are the proper way to go regarding pay. It's a very, very big deal.
And in that big deal, is there also a discussion of whether they will just walk away from this after all this time and all this energy, or whether that would be a mistake?
Good question. Millions of dollars, but some are wondering whether it's worth it to go forward. We will see under the new leadership of the HSTA. I would imagine this is going to be a discussion going forward.
And I imagine you and I will talk about it.
Yes, we will.
Thanks, Chad. Talk
Thanks,
to you
Bethany.
In the morning. Chad Blair reports on politics for CivilBeat.com.
This afternoon at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And today, a topic that does affect us all at some time, end-of-life care. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. This is part two. We discussed it last week. We're going to follow up with some answers to some questions this week and really try and help people understand why is this an important issue in their health care, not just when they're older, but really to start having these discussions now.
Not just for people in your family, but for yourself?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's one of those situations where under emergency in an emergency, you want to make sure that you know what your loved one would want. And although all of us, when we're younger, sometimes feel indestructible, as we get older or as our loved ones get older, we want to really understand what do they feel is their quality of life and when would they want to be kept around regardless of any issues or maybe not so much depending on their health status. So it's a discussion we all have to start thinking about at any age and really make sure that we have these discussions with our loved ones as they age.
And planning involves, is it going to be home care? Is it hospice? Is it hospital? I mean, so many of the variables depend on the individual.
They really do. And here in Hawaii, we have some issues with having enough areas for long-term care as far as beds. But we also have to talk about, you know, if somebody is in a situation where they're not safe alone, how can we make sure that we provide some sort of resources to them so that if they do have some type of an emergency, somebody's there to help. We're going to talk about the new Medicare potential coverage for advanced care planning. They just made a statement about 2 weeks ago that that's going to be part of the benefits to all Medicare beneficiaries. We're going to talk about why that's actually a good ruling and how that can really help people.
And as you get along in this help division, you can find out yourself it might apply to yourself as the clock keeps rolling.
It does for all of us, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Now, as we keep going along, the one thing I'd like to find out, is everything tied together? How honest do you be with the elder? I mean, some people seem to have this fear. Other people have this acceptance. Is it just how you accept it?
Well, the real issue is going to be the individual involved. So if somebody is really sick and having issues, if they've already written down what their wishes might be, then the job of the family is to respect those wishes. Mm-hmm. We don't have to agree. We don't have to go ahead and say yes. We support this decision. We just have to make sure that we respect the decision. And even in talking with my own parents, and my dad might actually do his advance directives on the show live this evening. I'm trying to twist his arm a little. But, you know, I might not agree with what he wants, right. But it's not up to me to agree. It's up to me to respect it.
That's right. It's our own clock, and it's going to be fascinating. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Malo lele, malo da mai bongbongin ko hingwa ko utulo langi. Tare gita we gi non-profit we go H5, pa go mo fano mai gi he program ko ni I he Hawaii Public Radio.
Thank you. Earlier in the show, we asked you to give us the name, the Hawaiian name, of the Sergeant Major damselfish, commonly found in and around the reefs throughout Hawaii. These damselfish are one of the most common reef fish in the state and can be seen just about every coral reef. One of its most well-known attributes is its ability to steal bait from fish hooks without getting caught. Reaching up to 10 inches in length as adults, they have yellowish-green bodies with light bellies and five dark vertical bars on each side. Males of the species have the ability to change the color of their bars, usually to yellow, and in rare cases of extreme aggression, they can even change their entire color scheme to dark blue. They're known in Hawaii as the ma'oma'o, or mamo for short, and these interesting reef fish are endemic to our islands and only found in Hawaiian waters. Our Sergeant Major, the ma'oma'o, or mamo. That's a quiz for today. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's 8:44. If you have a quiz, remember that's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Stargazer time, taking a look at what's happening in the universe as well as our island skies. When we turn, as usual, to Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us?
Hey, Dave. Venus and Jupiter will be setting earlier and earlier in the western sky just after sunset. Now, also setting in the west, but not till the early hours of the morning, will be Saturn. And we can expect Saturn to set around about 1:42 a.m. Now, the moon is currently waxing, and over the course of the next few days, it will become a bright presence in our island skies, perfect for the moonlit walks along the beach.
And I'm not thinking that any of those moonlit walks will feature the space butterfly recently discovered up at the Mauna Kea summit, but perhaps you can tell us more about it.
Yeah, well, this week we visit the twin telescopes of the Gemini Observatory. Now, scientists at Gemini have been studying a planetary nebula in an effort to construct one of the most accurate computer models of this beautiful object. This nebula happens to be shaped like a butterfly.
Planetary nebula.
Well, the name is a little bit misleading. These objects don't have anything to do with planets whatsoever. A planetary nebula is an enormous cloud of gas given off by a dying star. A star very much like our own sun, this distant planetary nebula known as NGC 2346. And it was produced when a star like our sun reached the end of its life and cast out its outer layers into space. Now, the problem with observing this nebula is that its light takes 2,300 years to reach us, and so we can't really see how it will evolve in real time.
Do we get to see any of the impact that the thing had on any planets that would be around it?
Well, the problem is these planets will be incredibly dim and incredibly small, so right now with our current telescopes, we couldn't really see what was going on.
I get it.
By using a computer model, we can estimate what will happen to this vast cloud of star stuff as it makes its way out into the galaxy. Now, the folks at Gemini have done just that. They have modeled the next 9,000 years in the life of this distant dying star. We can get a glimpse into the future of our own sun and the final years of its life.
I'm assuming that we're not hoping that our sun dies anytime soon, right?
We're very lucky. Not for another 4 or 5 billion years.
Thank you so much, Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, for this week's report.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
Most of us look forward to getting away on vacation and just taking it easy, eating, sipping something tropical, enjoying the sights. But sometimes we think maybe we can do something interesting and helpful on vacation as well. But how? Well, here's a very good way. Volunteer. Volunteering on vacation is a free program that makes it easy for Maui visitors and residents to help protect Maui's unique and fragile forests, shorelines, beaches, and open lands. And we're glad to have Lauren Blickley on the line with us today from the Valley Isle. Lauren, good morning, and thanks for volunteering to speak with us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Indeed. So here we are, vacationers, or come Inus, maybe doing a staycation. So how do we start volunteering? How do we find out about this?
Yeah, it's really easy. Volunteering on Vacation is a program that Pacific Whales started back in 2007 with funding from the Hawaii Tourism Association, and it's really grown and expanded over the last couple of years, and we have 5 different partner groups that we work with now, and we have a lot of visitors, obviously, coming in to Maui and supporting a lot of the industries here and going out on snorkel and whale watch with our eco cruises. But a lot of them wanted to give back and constantly asked ways, well, you know, how can I get more involved with Maui, or how can I see a different side of Maui that I wouldn't normally see on vacation? And that's really where the program came from and grew out of. And it's really easy just to call the Pacific Whale Foundation offices or to visit pacificwhale.org and talk to me, and I can help facilitate people getting onto these different activities and events that we have with the different organizations.
So the whales, which sort of primarily got the thing going as far as you're concerned, but it's expanded beyond the whales. This pretty much involves everything from the mountaintops to under the sea, essentially.
It does. We actually are leading every other week a group that goes up to Haleakala National Park. Mm-hmm. We're the only group that does front country invasive species removal up on Haleakala. We partner with a South Maui volunteers who are doing dune restoration all along the south coast of Maui, all the way to Hawaiian Island Land Trust and the Waiheke Coastal Refuge. And so there's a lot of different opportunities for people to get involved no matter what their interest is. And it's a unique program because it's only a couple hours of volunteering opportunities. So a lot of programs where you're going on vacation to volunteer, it's an entire week of volunteering. And this allows you to have your vacation or staycation, but also spend a couple of hours giving back, like we say. So it's really easy for somebody to fit into their vacation time.
So they provide transportation to a lot of the venues?
For our Haleakala, we do provide transportation. For most of the other venues, you have to take your own transportation and take your rental car, but we provide all of the information about how to get there. And I was going to say, there's also one for farmers out there. We added OO Farms, which is upcountry in Kula, so people who are interested in farming, as well as Malama Honokawai, which is a native Hawaiian restoration project in Honokawai Valley. So, again, a lot of different opportunities and really special chance to get to see a side of Maui that a lot of people don't get to see.
It sounds like the sort of Kokua extended to so many different organizations. Is this sort of running in parallel with the Eyes on the Reef people?
We actually have not set up one for Eyes on the Reef quite yet, although we do work extensively with Darla White and the Eyes on the Reef here on Maui. But we're always looking for chances to expand our volunteering on vacation program. So if there's organizations who are interested in being involved and being a partner organization, we ask them to reach out and get in touch with us, because we're always looking for new opportunities to add partners and to add opportunities for our volunteers.
It seems like it's not only getting the word out, but tourists and visitors trying to get the word in. Would you say it's about a 50-50 mix, or how's the interchange really, really working?
Yeah, right now we have, again, very heavy on our visitor side, which is really good. And, again, that's really where Pacific Whale Foundation is. We're in our ecotourism. And so that's where our biggest market is. But I really would encourage any local to come in and get involved and join us as well, because it's a lot of things that people who live on the island haven't ever done before, or who are looking on a Saturday, well, how can I give back and how can I be a part of something? And it's very, very easy. Again, it's flexible schedules. We also provide free beach cleanup kits from our offices in Ma'alaya, so we provide bags and gloves, and that can be done on anybody's time. So you can come by and get the kit and then pick your beach and make a difference just within an hour of picking up while walking along the beach.
So the volunteer provides the body and you provide the tools, essentially.
That's right.
Is there, for example, I imagine one of the most stunning things for visitors when they see a the Kohola, actually the Hawaiian humpback whale, actually sounding and the flukes coming up. Is this the sort of the main trigger point for a lot of people who wonder, how can I help? What do I do? That sort of, you're sort of baiting the hook of fascination with the beauty of the life in these islands.
That's so true. true, and I like how you put that because that's really what we tried to do here at Pacific Whale Foundation is the whales, you know, in my mind as conservation manager here is that's one point, and that's how to get people in, and that's what we really utilize. You get people excited about the ocean environment. You get people excited about whales or who are maybe just coming to Hawaii just to see whales, and then you use that as sort of a segue into how you can protect the oceans and how you can give back to these habitats, how you can give back to these islands. So it really is a conversation starter, the beginning point for a lot of people to get inspired, and then they're always looking for that next thing. Well, what can I do now? And volunteering on vacation is one of those opportunities.
So the actual, it seems to me, the best way we can help the whales is to make sure they have a habitat and sort of stay clear of them or just observing from a respectful distance. There aren't any actual volunteers going into the water to help the whales per se.
No, that is all done through the sanctuary right now as far as disentanglement efforts and professionals. So we do ask people to just give whales their space, but there's a lot of people that people can do outside of being in the water one-on-one with whales. I think that's a small aspect. We all, as individuals, play a role in making a difference for our ocean environment. And I think sometimes people think the oceans are so big, what can I really do as an individual? And it's really taking those steps as an individual, as your own family, and sort of looking inside and say, okay, what can we do? That's how we're going to make the biggest difference for our ocean environment.
And you seem to be making a big difference, and we're really, really glad that you opened our eyes to it. And again, thanks for volunteering to talk to us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Aloha. Lauren Blickley is a marine biologist based on Maui. She received her undergraduate degree from the University of Miami in Florida and a master's degree from the University of California at Santa Barbara. And she currently works as the Marine Conservation Programs Manager at Pacific Whale Foundation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at radianceroof.com.
On the next humankind.
I thought that was a very select class of people, that somehow you must be knighted a philanthropist or something, that you certainly had to grow up in it, or you lived in a certain zip code.
But the vast majority of Americans donate to charity, and a movement called Bolder Giving asks us to give more. I'm David Freudberg. Join us for Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
When you were talking with Senator Thielen this morning, I was fascinated how connections happen because I went to school with the son of the guy that actually dug those tunnels, and they were working during the Pearl Harbor attack. And I guess it doesn't seem like that long ago, and 70 years pass, and they seem permanent, but now they got problems, and somehow it comes full circle.
Well, they've always had problems. I don't think it's something that, as we are all finding out, is something that's of just the past few years. They've been leaking since the 40s. The question is, did we even know that they were there? Senator Thielen was suggesting that the state really didn't understand that they were there until perhaps the 80s or 90s, and then being able to dig through literally all the history, and we'll see what happens as this goes forward, and today being the last day for people to comment on the draft agreement.
Didn't need pumps or gravity-fed, but gravity pulled things down.
Right, and what contaminants may be pulled down into the water tables, well, that's what we're all trying to figure out and looking at the modeling that will be coming out of various different agencies, including the university. So we'll keep our eye on it, and we'll have more to talk about it as more information comes out. That's going to do it for us for today, but we'll be back with you tomorrow. And thank you very much, Bill Sage, for sitting in and being with us for the next couple weeks.
Well, thank you. And we'll be sitting down with AIA Medal of Honor architect Don Gu.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line anytime you like and leave comments at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you like Facebook, we're there too, at Hawaii Conversation, or we tweet at HI Conversation, or you can tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show and want a past one, you can find them on the HPR2 archive. Links to more conversation about guests and topics are there too. Just look under Talk Shows for the conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, and come back for more tomorrow right here for the conversation.